Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday before the Super Bowl, the 3rd of February. Dale Hoffman is our guest, and he's written a wonderful book along with Cliff Crystal, and it is titled 365, The Best Wisconsin Sports Stories Day by Day. Dale has had a 40-year journalism career and has covered every major Wisconsin sport as well as a number of national and international events, the Olympics, the Super Bowl, the Final Four, the World Series, the U.S. Open Golf Tournament. He was a Green Bay Packers and Milwaukee Bucks beat reporter before becoming a columnist for the Milwaukee Sentinel and later the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's a member of the Milwaukee Press Club Hall of Fame, was named one of the nation's top 10 sports columnists in 1998, and has won many other state and national writing awards, including one for a series filed from Saudi Arabia leading up to Desert Storm. It's a great pleasure to have him here. We're not only going to cover the Packers, but I know that's foremost on many of your minds. So there may be great moments in Packer history that you would like to remember as we enter the Super Bowl weekend. Actually, it's been a Super Bowl couple weeks. It's everywhere. The Super Bowl is everywhere. Hi, Dale. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Yeah, it seems like the Super Bowl has been going for 40 years, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really does. It just sort of goes on and on. I don't know how they feel any more local television news.
Boy, I remember that so well, too, because it's an all-day soccer. And actually, the leading up to the NFC Championship game, you've got a lot of national media up in Green Bay. So you are looking for fresh angles 7 days a week for 3 weeks. And there's five or six of you on your newspaper plus everybody else. So it's a little extreme.
Do you have a particularly unusual fresh angle that you would like to tell us about?
I have absolutely nothing to say that somebody hasn't already said.
Well, it gets to the point where the people down in Dallas, you know, they're talking about the weather all the time because there's supposed to be these events and nobody shows up for them because it's so cold and there's so much ice.
Yeah, I feel so bad for them. You know, it's down to 22 degrees or something like that, and there's there's ice on the sidewalks. You know, watch where you're going, Texans. You'll get there.
This book, now there were a lot. I love all the research that went into this because this isn't just the last 10 years. This is history. So you're looking at information, and I wonder how you got it that is in a time before there was newspaper.
Yeah, we go back about 150 years on this thing. And I've got to give 95, 98% of the credit for the research to Cliff because this was his idea. Cliff Crystal is a historian par excellence when it comes to local sports, to Wisconsin sports. And he'd had this idea. Cliff and I had done a book about 4 years ago on the greatest moments in Lambeau Field. And we're thinking, what next? And Cliff said, well, you know, I've always had this idea in my head. And it's so he had a lot of the stories figured out, you know. And what would happen is Cliff would disappear into the microfiche room and come out. Cliff had this deathly pallor by the time we were done with this thing because he never saw daylight, you know, and he's walking around in sunglasses and stuff. But so he'd gather all this stuff and then he'd send it to me in a pile, and then I'd go through it and just try and winnow it down to 600 words or 800 words or whatever it is. One of the first things I had to do was get a magnifying glass because, as you said, you know, you got newspapers there that are 110 years old or something like that, and it's just hard to make sense out of them unless you can read them. But it was fun. It was just it was extremely labor intensive.
I would imagine.
That was the thing. I think if we sell this book by the pound, we'll be okay.
And there were certain days that you looked at where several very important things happened in history, and you would have to select one of them.
Yeah, the one we were talking about before was there was a date in February where in the Packers' history where Vince Lombardi surrendered the coaching reins of the Packers. Curly Lambeau walked away from the Packers after basically founding them, and Ron Wolf resigned. You know, those are three momentous events in the history of the Packers, and we had to decide on which of the three we wanted. And we finally went with Lambeau because at that time it was an extremely controversial parting, and he was the Green Bay Packers at that time, you know. And that's one of the challenges here is to put some kind of historical context to this. I mean, I think most people would look at that and say, well, it's slam dunk. It's when Ron Wolf walked away, you know. But in the greater scheme of things, I would say that Lambeau was a bigger story.
Mm-hmm. Were you at the Ice Bowl?
I was not at the Ice Bowl. The Ice Bowl was 3 years before I got here. It's hard to believe that anything happened before I got here. But I got here in 1970, so I did not see. I remember seeing the Ice Bowl on television and thinking, "My God, what did this guy do?" And when I got to Milwaukee, I got my first sense of how important the Packers are. I grew up around Chicago. I try not to let that out, but it's
where
true.
Where did you grow up?
A little suburb called Hinsdale.
Oh, I grew up in Elk Grove and Des Plaines.
Okay, yeah, we were close, yeah. Mm-hmm. So when I got here, I knew people liked the Packers, but I just had no idea. I mean, it really is a religion around here, and you look at the season ticket waiting list and that kind of thing. And I don't know that there are any fans like Packer fans, any more loyal fans. So when I got here, I was just surprised at how pervasive that was.
Is that because of the community ownership, do you think, Dale?
I guess that's true, although I was here a while before I even knew about that.
Oh.
I think a lot of it just has to do with there's a football mentality around this state. And of course, the success. I mean, they had just such fabulous success with Lombardi. And people just expected that to keep happening. But they just don't walk away here. I mean, you can... we've got long stretches, where they were just awful. the years I covered them as a beat writer was the last year of Dan Devine and the first 4 years of Bart Starr. And those were dreadful teams, and they stayed dreadful for a long time, but people just never stopped coming. And that waiting list kept growing and growing. I think the season ticket waiting list, I heard a statistic once that the average age on the season ticket waiting list is 8 years old.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Well, yeah, because people know they're never going to get one.
Oh, my.
But they put their kids' names in as soon as they're born, on the outside chance that by the time they're 30 or 40 or something, they'll have a shot at a ticket.
Whew.
Nobody else does that.
No. So would you add, if they won on Sunday, would that be a story that would be included in the update?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're doing their best to make the book obsolete. You can certainly make a case for that for the game where they beat the Bears to get into the Super Bowl. You can certainly make a case for this Super Bowl. I mean, those two would supplant whatever we happen to have on those dates. And I don't even remember what that is. Well, yeah, actually, I think I remember one of them. That was the Al McGuire jump up on the table story against Wisconsin. I don't know how many people remember that, but. This was when Marquette was just excellent, and Wisconsin wasn't very good. But they were rated that year, and all week long, McGuire had been saying, this rivalry is just getting away from us. We're going to have to tone this down a little bit and remember it's a basketball game, and let's not do anything to inflame fans any more than we already have. Well, all right, the game comes along, and Wisconsin's got this lead. And Maurice Lucas, who recently died, who was a great Marquette player and a good pro, sinks this shot with 1/10 of a second left or something like that. And Al jumps up on the scorer's table and turns to the Wisconsin fans with his arms raised in the air. And we have a great picture of this.
Yes.
At the Journal Sentinel, where in the crowd is Glenn is... I can't remember what the father's first name was, but yeah, Glenn Hughes. He had twins, Kim and Carrie Hughes, who started for the Wisconsin team. And Kim had missed three free throws down the stretch, which basically lost the game. And so Glenn gave him the traditional single figure finger tribute. And there was a wonderful picture of that ran in the Journal. It ran in the Sentinel too, but someone got kind of prudish. And airbrushed out the finger. So I mean, I love that story, but it would be a casualty of the NFC Championship game that we just saw. If we do get around to reprinting this thing,
right? McGuire was a wonderful source of comedy, and oh my gosh, the guy must have been fun to follow.
He was amazing. He was my first beat, and. I mean, I had 4 years of Al McGuire, and then I went from that to Dan Devine. And that was, if you remember Dan Devine at all, that was culture shock in the extreme, because I thought everybody was like Al. I found out later on that nobody's like Al, I mean, you talk about access. I could walk into those practices during a practice. Now, you know, you practically need a security clearance to get near a practice in a lot of places. But I just sit down with Al and he'd talk while the practice was going on, while Hank Raymond was running the practice, and Al would just talk to me. And he'd look at you and he'd say, well, do you have enough? Wow. At one time, just because he did that all the time, and I finally said, no, give me a little bit more, will you? So he kept talking. Al was one of the great, great characters. I mean, we've talked sometimes about if you had a sports Mount Rushmore with local characters, local coaches, players, and that, who would be the four or five guys that you'd put up on there? And Al would certainly be one of those.
Who would be the others?
Well, I think you'd have to go for Lombardi. You could certainly make a case for Bud Selig. Mm-hmm. Up until a couple of years ago, I think Brett Favre would go up there, but now I'm afraid someone would be out there taking that down. They'd be sandblasting that. You know. But guys like that, Robin Yount, you'd have to consider. Mm-hmm. People in that vein.
Yeah. Hank Aaron, one of the...
Oh, absolutely. Hank Aaron would be another one, yeah.
Yeah, there's one of the stories. I can't remember what page it was on. I've taken all these notes, but I can't find them now. I can't find the page it's on. When he returned to Milwaukee, do you remember that story in the book when Bud Selig calls him with a special message and wants him to come back to Milwaukee?
Yeah, he's in... Hank Aaron is in Japan at the time.
Right, right.
And if I remember this correctly, he was doing a home run hitting... exhibition there because the Japanese had Sandahara Oh, who actually held the world record for home runs, I guess, if you consider Japanese baseball major league, and he called Henry Aaron in Japan. Bud Selig called him and said, come on back, you know, I mean, you've meant so much to this city and everything, could you come here as a designated hitter? And Aaron, at that time, knew he was going. He was near the end of his career, and was very interested in getting into some kind of front office position, which at the time was kind of a racially charged issue. And as it turned out, he did do that with Atlanta, but he definitely wanted to be part of the Brewers situation as long as Bud was there. And of course, he and Bud were great friends.
Mm-hmm. Brewers history, when the Seattle Pilots moved to Milwaukee, March 31st is the date in the book. That was a big day for Milwaukee. I mean, baseball, we underestimate how important baseball has been to this city.
Yeah, and it was one of my earliest memories because that was 1970. I got here in January of 70, and I just remember all the excitement that was being generated by that. And the idea of getting there. There was a guy on our staff though who had been through the Braves thing. This is on the Brewers staff or on the Sentinel staff at that time, who had been through all the Braves experience and remembered how much work that was, you know. And so he was pulling for the Pilots to stay in Seattle. I remember him saying that he was lighting candles for the people in Seattle.
No.
Yeah, but that was huge. I mean, I think that just transformed everything around here because, you know, summers were kind of a dead spot for sports coverage in Milwaukee at that time. And County Stadium was sitting out there and the White Sox were playing once in a while, but the Brewers made all the difference. There's always been a debate about whether Milwaukee's a baseball town. And I've always thought it has been, you know, and I think they've demonstrated, I think the fans here have demonstrated that in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, when you draw 3 million fans for sub 500 teams, you know it's a baseball city.
Yeah, it sure is. And it's a nice stadium. It's good to have
it's,
them here.
It's
still.
A gorgeous stadium.
Isn't
it really
it?
Is.
Yeah, it's yeah. Beautiful. Boxing at the University of Wisconsin, that's quite a story from the 1930s where a young athlete, promising athlete, died.
Yeah, his name was Charlie Moore, and this was kind of a sad story.
He
was
really sad.
He's a 22-year-old senior fighting in his last fight. I think it was 165 pounds. He was the defending NCAA champion in this. And he'd said before that, you know, when this bout is over, I'm done with boxing. You know, and he was a promising boxer, but he'd had it and enjoyed it. He was fighting a friend from San Diego State, someone he'd known for a long time. As a matter of fact, they had been talking to one another before the fight, you know, just about things in general. They'd kept up with each other for a long time. second round, and they'd fought twice before that year, or yeah, that in that same year, and they'd split the two decisions. Second round, Charlie Moore gets flattened by a blow, and we're not exactly sure where it landed or anything, but gets up, but you know, isn't himself, and the referee counts him out. He goes back to the corner. The coach says, you know, do you know what day it is? Oh yeah, I'm fine. You know, don't worry about it. Actually signs autographs on the way back to the dressing room, and then collapses in the dressing room. They rush him to the hospital. He has a subdural hemorrhage. They work on him for 5 hours. Give him last rites on the table.
Oh my!
Yeah. 8 days later, he dies. They didn't think he had any kind of a chance to begin with. His sisters were there. The parents came. And 20 days, I think it was, after that, the University of Wisconsin drops boxing as a sport. And Wisconsin had won 8 NCAA championships. But they dropped the sport. And as soon as they dropped the sport, everybody else did. A sidelight on that was Charlie Moore's father wrote a letter to the guy who beat him and said, we just want you to know that no one in the family thinks this is your fault.
Oh, that guy must have felt just
terrible.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. And they were friends.
Oh, my. What a story. Let's go to phone calls. All our lines are humming here. Our number is 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org. Dale Hoffman is our guest. He was sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and longtime reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel, co-author of 365, the best Wisconsin sports stories day by day. We, of course, are doing this today because we're close to the Super Bowl and the Packers figure prominently in this book, but so do the Braves and the Brewers and Marquette and UW teams and other individuals, actually. We need to talk about Dan Jansen, which was a marvelous story. People who went to the Olympics, tennis players, and others. But we'll take your phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dale Hoffman is our guest, and we start taking phone calls now. Dan from Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you how blessed I am from coming to Wisconsin. I'm a transient from Michigan, but I came to Wisconsin in 1957, and I grew up in Detroit playing baseball and seeing a lot of baseball because my granddad's sister was Mrs. Walter O. Briggs, whose husband owned the Tigers and Briggs Stadium. My granddad and I went to oodles of baseball games. Well, 1957, the Milwaukee Braves won the World Series. I saw every game that was played. I was a college freshman, and I saw every game that was played in Milwaukee for under $100. And I went to Marquette and saw the last of Coach Hickey and the start of Al McGuire. I worked for a firm that represented Al McGuire and also Fuzzy Thurston and Max McGee in some left guard restaurants. And in addition to that, even though they have, and this gives everything away, right? Even though there's a freeway named after me in Chicago, I'm still a Packer fan. I got two words for this weekend. Go Pack!
Thanks for the call. Do you want to go to 1957 for a moment?
I just wanted to congratulate him on his decision to come here in 1952. I think it's remarkable. He brings up the price of, he was there for, what did he say? You can't park at a World Series game right now for that kind of money. I think those were better times in a lot of ways. The thing I've always heard about the old Braves were that you could run into them in a grocery store. That's one of the things I think that sports has lost, and that's just the interface between fans and players. Those guys had to work for a living after the baseball season. You know, I'm not saying that should necessarily be the case, but I think it's really good that fans could feel – physically as well as emotionally close to these players.
Well, it does. Does it detract from the game at all? It's hard for me not to look at some of these salaries, and I know people make it in other professions, in television and actors and actresses, but there's something about the love of a game, and now you couple that with $15 million, $110 million, it just seems crazy to me, Dale.
Well, and the NFL is going to be confronting that very soon. I mean, the NFL has record revenues right now. They're making much more money than they ever have before. And yet we're talking about a very, very strong possibility of a work stoppage in March because the owners think that the players are getting too big a piece of the revenues. I think that whole thing has gone out of whack. I mean, there was a time when the television contract in the NFL covered all the team's expenses. I mean, anything that went through the gate was gravy. And the NFL has a great business model. I mean, the idea of the shared revenues and all that kind of thing just makes a lot of sense. But it's getting perverted, and I just wonder. I mean, as popular as this game is, if you have a work stoppage, how many people walk away?
Yeah, people do walk away, don't they?
Away. It certainly happened in baseball, and it took a long time to get that squared away. Again, actually, it took a home run chase that was later tainted by steroids, but you're going to need something like that to get it stoked up again.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan, for your call. Let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if Dale could address this, what I think, absurd notion of an anthropoid on the cervical or thoracic regions of an athlete's spinal column or monkey on his back. It only seems to surface when a promising player or coach immediately follows a great player or coach. In this case, Aaron Rodgers following Brett Favre. Obviously, it didn't seem to surface when Mike Holmgren followed Vince Lombardi because it was 30 years intervening. But it seems to me that this notion is a sports media-created fiction that's only viable if the promising player or coach allows it to be. And I would say to Aaron Rodgers, all he has to do is play his best, let history take care of itself, and ignore any references to a monkey being on his back. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Mike.
I think a couple things about that. I do think it's a media creation. Much the same as can't win the big one. You hear that all the time about certain players who will never be considered great because, or coaches who won't be considered good because they didn't win the big one. And in some cases, that's the Super Bowl. Sometimes it's the it's the World Series. Lost in that is the fact that how many big ones did they have to win to get to that point? And no one ever seems to think of that. I mean, they just remember the last game they lost. As for the monkey on Aaron Rodgers' back, who has ever handled that better? I think we're hearing so much about how it benefited Rodgers to be under Brett Favre's tutelage. I don't know that Brett Favre did much tutoring. I mean, I think he was doing his job, and he said that Rodgers can watch and learn, and I think that's exactly what happened. I think what Rodgers benefited from was not having to start right away, not having to carry the team around. It helped a lot that he was able to season gradually. But certainly the whole thing about sitting there and following Favre, he's just handled that magnificently. And, of course, he's handled it magnificently because he's performed so well.
Hmm. I want to talk about superstitions for a moment. I, as you know, come from a family of big sports fans. And our son, when we were watching the playoff game, when was it? A couple weeks ago, he came home from school and I washed the Green Bay Packers shirt and he said, "Oh my gosh, Mom, you washed the shirt." I said, "Well, it was a little smelly, Andrew. I had to wash the shirt." "I can't believe you washed the shirt. They're going to lose." And I had to
laugh
a little bit.
He's over that now, isn't he?
He is over that now, but I'm sure that shirt has not been washed since then for Sunday's game. And I want to talk about superstitions. You've covered all of these athletes in all of these sports. Are there some that are much more superstitious than others?
I think there are some. I think sometimes you get the superstitions mixed up with the rituals, too. I mean, there are people who just do things the same way every time. Great free throw shooters, for instance, will bounce the ball exactly the same number of times. They'll they'll bend knees and that kind of thing. But you know what? I think it's about being comfortable. I don't know that that they know that a particular ritual makes a lot of difference, except that it's something that they've always done when they've been successful. And so they have these successful memories, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I grew up with that too. I mean, my mother was an incredible, still is, a Cubs fan. And those were the days when you'd listen to them on the radio. And if you happened to get trapped in a room with her when the Cubs were winning and you were sitting down somewhere and you got up to leave the room, you're not going anywhere. Not till this game is over.
Let's go to Boyd next in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen. Glad you made it to work today. I got to see if I can make it to work today. And hello, Dale. Actually, my question is this, sort of a history question for the future. I know Brett Favre has been mentioned a few times. How do you think history is going to judge him? I personally think he has totally disgraced himself. Not only from what he has done to the Packers organization, but now you hear all these reports of what he was involved in off the field. And, you know, I will say, in fairness, I don't expect the athletes to be perfect. I certainly don't. I screen the Bucks, and I see them a few times throughout the months. And if people ask me, what are they like? I'd say, they're no different than you and I. They just like to play basketball. So I understand they're not perfect. But I just think what he's done, I don't see his number being retired, and that's really all to say.
You know, it's interesting. I've been posing that same question to people. How will Favre be looked at 10 years from now? And in most cases, people are thinking that he will be remembered as the player he was when he was here. And I certainly hope that's the case. I mean, the kinds of off-the-field stuff he's involved or he's been allegedly involved in, it's kind of a full circle thing. I mean, remember, when he got to Green Bay, he was considered a wild man. And then he kind of settled down, and then these other things are coming along. I think of Bart Starr, who certainly wasn't involved in the off-the-field kinds of things. But Bart Starr was a wonderful quarterback and a terrible coach. And he comes back now, and all anyone remembers is the wonderful quarterback. And I just think that the Packer fans are forgiving, and that I will be astounded if the number isn't retired. I mean, that would just be a terrific injustice, because I happen to think that Brett Favre is the best player the Green Bay Packers have ever had. So I think he'll be looked at kindly. It's interesting, too, because I think the players may worry about that more than the fans do. Bob Harlan tells me that – I don't know how many people remember Jim Carter. Jim Carter was a linebacker, a good linebacker, an all-pro linebacker at one time, who replaced Ray Nitschke. And no one ever forgave him, it seemed, for replacing Ray Nitschke. I mean, because people wanted Nitschke to play forever. Carter came in there, was kind of brash to begin with, and had a good career, 7 or 8 year career with the Packers. Has not come back. Bob Harlan, the former Packer president, tells me has not come back for a single Packer function in Green Bay, just because he feels he won't be welcome. And Harlan is trying to tell him, you're just wrong. I mean, people would love to see you again.
Huh. Talk about, and I wonder if this has changed at all, there was a time when it was difficult for African-American players to be in Green Bay because, you know, there weren't a lot of places to get your hair cut and people didn't feel very welcome there. Have things progressed quite a bit? Is it easier to be a black player now in Green Bay?
Everyone gives Reggie White credit for that.
And really?
I think it's probably true. I think Reggie White made it okay for a black player to take a chance in Green Bay, because I mean, he could have gone anywhere, you know. And I've never lived in Green Bay. I've heard those stories. I know that it used to be that the Packers would have Monday off and get to Milwaukee as soon as they can. But I think they're a lot more comfortable there now than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Boyd, so much for the call. We go to Jerry in Madison next. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen. I was wondering if your guest could tell us the origins of the Chicago Bears, where they originated.
No. I believe they started in Decatur, Illinois,
yes.
And were called the Stanley Steamers at the time. And then
they were called the they were a company team by the A.E. Staley Company, and they were called the Staley Bears.
Okay. Yeah, I knew it was something like that, but I haven't. I know that Halas and Lambeau were friends in addition to being great competitors. And actually, when the Packers dedicated what was then called City Stadium, which later became Lambeau Field, Halas was one of the people who was pushing the referendum to get that done, and that was a story in itself. Matt Dillon, Marshall Dillon from Gunsmoke and Miss America, they were all there for the parade, and Halas said that it was extremely very necessary for the Packers to do this. It was good for the league. It was good for the Packers. What I thought was interesting about that is. The referendum that paid for that stadium was $970,000. They're playing the Super Bowl right now in a stadium that costs $1.3 billion. Do the math. I don't know. But it gives you a really good indication of A, where the league is going, and B, why it's having some financial problems and why they might actually talk about a lockout in March.
Mm. Thank you, Jerry, very much for the call. Tell us this was such a touching story, the Dan Jansen story. There wasn't a dry eye, I think, reading about that event.
I've always said that, to me, that was the highlight of my career. It's the best story I think I've ever covered. I don't know how. You know, the thing about speed skaters is nobody thinks about them until the Olympic years. And Dan Jansen was just far and away the king of speed skating all over the world. But no one in the United States knew it. I mean, he'd walk down a street in Holland and he'd be mobbed, you know. But he just had terrible luck in the Olympics. I think everyone remembers when he fell in Alberta right after his sister had died. Of cancer, and then he'd been disappointed. So anyway, we get to Norway, and Jansen basically has two more major Olympic races to run. I mean, everyone knows he's never going to skate again in the Olympics after this. Still hasn't gotten an Olympic medal. Another one who's been accused of not winning the big one. Skates in the 500 meters, which is his specialty. He's much better than any other 500 meter skater in the world. And slips again and doesn't medal in the 500. So now he's down to the 1,000 meters. And no one expects him to win that. He's got like the fourth or fifth best time. And comes out of that and just skates the race of his life in the very final Olympic competition he's ever going to have. Actually comes out of a little slip. And the race is wonderful, but what's so much better is the aftermath. He crosses the finish line. And his wife comes down from the stands and brings his little daughter down there. And a security guard hands him to the security guard. And the daughter's name is Jane, named after the sister who died. Security guard hands little Jane to Dan Jansen, who takes her in one arm. He's got the medal around his neck. And he's got a bouquet of flowers in the other hand. The Norwegians pick up on the moment beautifully. They train a spotlight on him. And then there's classical music. I can't remember what it was, and then there's just the music and the spot following him as he skates this slow victory lap with his daughter. I was sitting there in the stands in the press area. And you have to know something about how the press works in the Olympics. They have a thing called the mixed zone, which is underneath most of the stadiums. And what happens is you interview the reporters are on one end of a rope, one side of a rope, and then the athletes pass by. And so basically you're trying to stop them and talk to them. And, of course, you know the mixed zone is going to be an absolute zoo when Jansen wins this thing. And I've got a decision to make. I'm thinking, yeah, I could go down there, you know, but in the next section over is the Jansen family.
Uh-huh.
And so I think, you know, what's better than the mixed zone is actually talking to that family. So I make my way over there, and I've got the wrong credential. They won't let me in. And Dan Jensen's father comes over and gets me because he sees that I'm, that I'm trying to get to him. And then so I'm standing next to Dan Jensen's father as he skates around there with the baby on the spotlight, and the tears are just streaming down his face. His face.
I imagine.
There will be no better moment for me in this business. I knew that right then.
What a story. All right, let's go to more phone calls. June in Shawano is next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
I was struck by the emotion relating the story of Dan Jensen. And it's one thing I like about sports. Their emotion is loud. And I agree with you about Brett Favre. I think we'll forget all that, forget the jokes and everything. He was a great player. My big deal is on Saturday, we will have the 77th birthday of Henry Aaron. And he was a hero who never let me down. I love all sports, but baseball has always been my best. And I think that, like I said, he was a hero and will always be.
He's a hero of mine as well. He and people don't realize he's a quiet man in many ways, but he's a very heroic man.
Baseball, I think, just owns a special spot in America, and Henry Aaron owns a special spot in baseball. We actually have a thing in the book about what it was like when Hank Aaron broke into baseball. He started in Eau Claire, lived in a YMCA. He was picked up at the airport when he got to Eau Claire from the team's publicity director, whatever you want to call him, and he took him in for a day. Just to get him acclimated, brought him to his house, and Henry Aaron had never been in a white person's house before, and he could tell he was just extremely nervous. You know, there were a couple other black players on that team, and as it turned out, they were welcomed with open arms in Eau Claire. You know, and then of course, I mean, it all started at Eau Claire for Hank Aaron, who was just by any definition an incredible class act, who was not terribly quiet about things all the time, though. I mean, I thought he was a leader in many ways in race relations in baseball. In a way, for instance, that Michael Jordan never was. Henry Aaron used his position in his worship for good for people, not so much for money. And I think people really recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, June, so much for the call. Janet is next in Sauk City. Hi, Janet.
Hi. First, I want to thank you for having this show. You rarely do ones on sports, which I appreciate, but I love football. Some of your listeners will probably be upset you're doing sports, but me for one, which I listen to you all the time, I want to thank you. But my question for the guest is, has or how many times has a sixth seed wild card team been to the Super Bowl? And if, I mean, I don't think they ever have on the NFC, but on the AFC have they? And if so, have they won? And also last night on Inside the NFL, two of the people said the Packers would win, and one, Phil Simms, said the Packers are going to lose. It was the most interesting show. But I was hoping maybe your guest know this, and I really and want to say I appreciate you having this show. Thank you.
Thanks, Janet. Thanks for the call.
And I'm going to be wrong about this, but I'm almost sure that the Oakland Raiders were a sixth seed one year, but that was the AFC. I think the Packers would be the first sixth seed, certainly the first sixth seed to from the NFC to win the championship. As far as who's going to win the game, boy, that's all over the lot, but everyone seems to think that the Packers will win this game. They're 2.5 to 3-point favorites. the only evidence I've seen against it was the John Madden computer game where they lost it 40 times out of 100 or something like that.
How do you become – I don't understand how that works. How do you become a 2.5 to 3-point favorite? Why were they such favorites over the Bears? How does that work?
It's just a question of what people think is going to happen. I mean, they look at where
it's
the money
betting?
Comes from. Yeah,
it's betting.
It's all about Las Vegas betting. Yeah, yeah. And the Bear thing was remarkable because they were favorites against a team that was playing at home and was a second seed and had won the division championship in the division where they were. But the people were right. I personally will be very surprised if the Packers don't win this game.
Really?
Yeah, I just think they're playing at such a high level right now, and this is when you want to play at that level. I understand the Steelers are playing very well right now too, but to me, when I watch the Packers barely lose at New England to when they didn't have their best player, when they didn't have their quarterback, I thought, boy, this team is something special.
Mm.
And I just think they are. I mean, there's incredible depth on this team. They figure to get better, actually, next year, although that is never a given. But, I mean, they come up with mysterious running backs and phantom linebackers and stuff, people you've never heard of before, who just perform at a great level. And I just think they'll win this game.
Hmm. Chrissy mentioned something about the Steelers in 2005-2006. Who won that year?
Yeah, but it's an AFC team.
AFC team. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Let's we got to pause for a moment and we'll return. Dale Hoffman is our guest this hour. He and Cliff Crystal have authored a really interesting book, 365 The Best Wisconsin Sports Stories Day by Day, with a foreword, we might add, by David Marinus. So we'll be with more of your calls momentarily. One line is open, and we have an email we'll get to as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dale, were there any outstanding female athletes that made their way into the book, or are those years still ahead of us?
No, there are a few. Well, more than a few, actually. There's a couple golfers who were extremely good. There's a whole double truck on the this, as it turns out, is the biggest story, is the longest story of the book, was a women's professional baseball team that did quite well during the war years. That's evolving. And if we were to write this book 10 years from now, I think the percentage of female athletes would be much higher than it is now. In the greatest moments, you have to understand, of course, that this didn't really start to happen until Title IX,
mm-hmm.
This is just something that was way overdue. Really had to happen. You know, I don't know that women's athletics will ever become a great spectator sport. I kind of think of that as the way I think of soccer. You keep hearing that it's going to turn the corner and
right.
become a fan favorite, and it just doesn't happen. But, I mean, I think the opportunity for participation is so much greater now, and it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see more of that.
Bonnie Blair, another speed skater who was captivating.
And that's right. And Bonnie Blair was it. Bonnie Blair, to my mind, was one of the toughest, mentally toughest athletes I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I just if my life depended on somebody winning a race or succeeding, Bonnie Blair would be the person I'd want skating for me.
Saving a lot.
Partly because Bonnie Blair wouldn't care that my life was at stake. I mean, Bonnie Blair would just care about winning, and that's what she did. She just had this incredible mental toughness to her.
Hmm. Let's go next to Dave. And Dave is in Augusta, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Augusta is the town that Dan Devine was born in many years ago. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. And anyway, my question is regarding Dan Devine. He became Packer coach after Phil Bengston, I think, in 1970 or 71. His first game, first regular season game with the Packers as a coach, he broke his leg. He got hit on the sidelines by, I think, a defensive player for the New York Giants. I think they lost that game 42-40. But you talk about a man who had a big challenge ahead of him, Dan Devine did. He not only was in the shadow of Vince Lombardi, well, after Phil Bengtson, but he had aging Packer players like Willie Wood, Herb Adderley, Forrest Gregg, Bart Starr, Ray Nischke, and he had to replace all of these players who were fan favorites, of course. Nobody wanted to see him leave. I heard you talk about Ray Nischke earlier with Jimmy Carter, but I just want to know your thoughts on that.
Dan Devine was, I covered him for 1 year. I think a lot of people forget that Dan Devine won a division championship with the Packers, the first one, and I don't know how long it had been since the Lombardi times, and was named Coach of the Year after breaking that leg. But unfortunately, Dan Devine will be remembered, I think, in Wisconsin for two things. One was when a neighbor shot his dog, and the other was the John Hadle trade. Where they, I think they gave away five number one, twos, or three picks for John Hadle, who was at that point a second string quarterback, and it really crippled them for years to come. I remember Hog Hanner was the defensive coordinator who was talking about no big Devine fan who called the Hadle trade the Lawrence Welk trade. Because he gave up a one and a two and a three. he was a complicated guy, and he was a smart guy. I mean, he knew that he was going to be done after his last season there, and he jumped before he could be pushed. I mean, he went right from the Packers to Notre Dame, which is not a bad college job. And I remember he won the national championship with Notre Dame playing in Texas. And, of course, I'd known him, and he kind of pulled me aside after the game, and he said, I just want to say one thing to the people of Wisconsin. And I thought, uh-oh, what's this going to be? And he said, I want them to understand it's a lot harder to win a national championship than it is an NFL championship.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dave, for the call. We go to Elaine from Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. My husband and I went to training camp this year, and we saw Brett Swain. He's a wide receiver for the Packers, and he wasn't in pads. And we made a joke. I don't know if it was my husband or I that he looked like Jesus, because he has long brown hair, like a soulful brown eyes, and he was walking around to each position of players, each group, and we were kind of joking that Jesus is here. He's blessing all the positions. You know, he went to the quarterbacks, and then we'd see him with the defensive backs, and so we were making this joke, and we carried it all season. We'd say, well, Jesus is on the team. Brett Swain is there. After all the injuries started piling up, we still continued this little joke we had that, oh, well, they really needed Jesus because look at all the terrible injuries. And it's even funny because look where they are now. I mean, all these minor players that aren't, you know, household names have really made this team. And Brett Swain may be one of those contributors on special teams. But what's even funnier is when we developed our photographs, we realized we had a picture of Brett Swain, and he was standing amongst all these children, and his hand was up in a beatific gesture like Jesus, and his long brown hair was curled just like the old Jesus paintings. So I just want to say, you know, this funny incident that happened way back in training camp seems to be prophetic.
Well, and you know, hair is taking on a
what's with the hair?
There's a big thing. Well, it's Clay Matthews and Troy Polamalu with Pittsburgh, and who finished, well, Polamalu won, and Matthews was second, finished 1-2 in the defensive player of the year voting. I'd like to think it has nothing to do with their hair, but if you sure wouldn't cut it off, would you? You've got a Samson's thing going there. People are saying who has better hair rather than who's the better player between those two. You know, you're talking about people who came through, and that's all about Ted Thompson. And I've got to admit, I've done a bigger 180 on Ted Thompson than anyone ever I have in my life. I just think he's done an incredible job doing exactly what he said he was going to do, developing and drafting players. So that's why you can have 14, 17 people on injured reserve and still be in the Super Bowl, because he built so much depth here, and the team is so young. Not the most media-friendly guy. I mean, he's not unfriendly. He's just someone who is not going to give you much more than yes or no, you know, but boy, there's just no disputing what he's done.
Hmm. Is there one story? We only have about 30 seconds left. Is there one knockout story that we've neglected?
Boy, there's one, but I don't think I can do it in 30 seconds. There's a guy named Pat O'Day who was a place kicker for the University of Wisconsin. He was recruited because he was watching practice one day and a ball rolled over to him and he kicked it back out of the field. He became the first All-American in Wisconsin history, got a law degree, went to San Francisco where he was tired of talking about football. So he decided to drop out of sight, created an entirely new identity for himself. And for 25 years, people thought Pat O'Day was dead. Pat O'Day finally decided he was tired of being dead and re-identified himself as who he was, got in touch with the people in Wisconsin who didn't believe him, had to produce credentials and clips and everything, and was finally welcomed back in Wisconsin. A day after he died, he was named to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, or the College Football Hall of Fame.
What a story. Thank you, Dale. It's been a great hour. Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Dale Hoffman, the book is 365, The Best Wisconsin Sports Stories Day by Day. And where do you get it? You can buy it at the store?
You can buy it at the stores. You can do it down online, too.
All right. Great. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for doing on-air production. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. We'll be with you again on Monday at 9 for all things political. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Great conversations ahead.